I'm Emily Jashinsky.
I'm Josh Hammer.
I'm Rachel Bovard.
And I'm Ben Weingarten.
And this is NatCon Squad, where common good and common sense meet. NatCon Squad is produced by the Edmund Burke Foundation, the home for national conservatism. Make sure to subscribe now on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we have a great post-NatCon 2 show on the docket for everyone. There's a lot to sort of unpack in recent events, and with the sort of fresh lens of the conference that we were all fortunate to attend, I think it's going to be excellent. We're starting off with lessons from the Virginia elections, which unfolded while people were actually at the conference, which made for interesting content for sure. We're then going to talk about a huge update. Josh is going to cover Virginia. Ben is going to cover a huge update in the Russian collusion hoax that transpired in the last week. Rachel's going to talk about how the Republicans have helped Democrats take over the country with their massive social spending plan that is laundered under the label of infrastructure. And I'm going to talk about anti-racist infrastructure. So that'll be the second half of the show, digging into these massive bills that are making their way through Congress. So with that, I'll kick it over to Josh.
Okay, so first of all, thank you to everyone in the listening or viewing audience who was there at NatCon 2. If we met you, I'm sure it was lovely to meet you. And if we didn't meet you, hopefully you'll come up at a future NatCon conference. But speaking of Virginia, that did transpire while a lot of us were still there in Orlando. Specifically, it transpired during J.D. Vance's parting keynote address. We kind of all found out in real time. I guess J.D. himself kind of found out from the stage while he was talking that Glenn Youngkin had pulled it off in the Commonwealth of Virginia there. So to kind of just, you know, bring us back to get us all on the same page here, Virginia for decades was a solidly red state. It consistently voted for Republicans from, really for at least like a half century, really kind of going up until around 2006 with the kind of the George Allen Senate race at that time. Then Bob McDonnell in 2009 was the last Republican to win statewide there in the gubernatorial race. And over the past 12 years since Bob McDonnell won 2009, it really has trended consistently towards a light blue direction. Kind of Virginia, Colorado, or kind of your quintessential kind of formerly red turned light blue states. Biden carried it by double digits over Donald Trump last fall. Glenn Youngkin, along with the lieutenant governor and the attorney general, have kind of returned Virginia to the GOP column here. And it's worth talking about why that happened. And specifically, kind of from my perspective, at least, what happened and was really cool. We got to kind of, those of us who were in Orlando, got to celebrate this victory with Chris Rufo there, of all people. This largely happened, it seemed, on the kind of the education and critical race theory issue kind of leading the way. Terry McAuliffe had this gaffe of all gaffes in late September where he basically said, parents, you shouldn't have anything to do with your children's education. What do you care about that for? And education after that gaffe, and he said that in a debate around like September 26, 27, something like that. Education after that surpassed the economy as the number one issue for Virginia voters. And over the next month, from late September to late October in the lead up to the election, for people for whom education was the number one voting issue in Virginia, Washington Post poll showed they switched over the course of that month 42 points in the direction to Glenn Youngkin from Terry McAuliffe. So I do not think it's an exaggeration to say that the Commonwealth of Virginia returned to the Republican column, really kind of on the critical race theory issue, which is at its core kind of a culture war issue. Okay, this kind of is kind of an issue that sits at the thorny intersection of parental rights, kind of this conservative focus on the family versus kind of the leftist focus, obviously, on the government with public school teachers and kind of the public school bureaucracy in general, race, identity, politics. I mean, you name it. This is kind of like critical race theory, from my perspective, is kind of like about as true of a culture war issue as you can possibly get here. And the upshot is that Republicans won not by ducking this fight, but by diving headlong into it, by aggressively taking it up. And, you know, look, Glenn Youngkin, he's not exactly like a MAGA guy to his core or anything, right? I mean, Carlyle Group and all of that. I mean, so the way that he did it, he wasn't out there kind of giving like fiery tweets or anything, but he was making very common sense arguments, the likes of which are basically that if you're the parents, you should control your children's education, period. Or if we can kind of extend the analogy and take it away from critical race theory to kind of some of these other kind of culture war, kind of woke issues where, you know, on this podcast, we've been saying for months and months and months, about how the median American no longer sides with the woke left on this crazy stuff. You know, Loudoun County obviously also had like that the horrific incident that, you know, that Lou Grossiak of the Daily Wire uncovered with respect to the, what happened in, with the transgender student in the bathroom there. Well, look, the median American, similarly, just like they don't want the woke public school bureaucracies to indoctrinate their children in racial and national self-hatred, they don't want biological men unzipping their flies and just whipping it out and peeing in the women's bathroom. I mean, this is just like common sense stuff here. So I guess my takeaway from the Virginia election, I'll kind of just open up the panel on this note, is it's what we've been saying on this podcast for months and months. We should, all four of us should feel vindicated here, which is the path forward for conservatism, for the Republican Party, however you want to define it, is not by ducking these cultural fights, but by taking them head on, doing so obviously in kind of a, you know, a prudential fashion. Don't like say like stupid crap, obviously. That's for the political messengers. That's really not my area. But don't avoid them. Tackle them. Don't stick to kind of the bread and butter, quote unquote, fiscally conservative, socially liberal pabulum that like the K Street consulting class dished out for decades, including the infamous 2012 RNC autopsy that Ryan's previous commission. That could not have been more wrong. And I think Virginia proved that it was wrong. So I, for one, am happy. I think all four of us, frankly, should feel vindicated. So I'm happy just to kind of open it up to you guys. If, you know, are you as optimistic as I am about this?
Just really quickly, I'll say I do feel vindicated. And basically, I wrote an entire column with my boss, Ben Dominich, spiking the football, as we put it, because there's a Ronald Reagan truism about speaking in bold colors and not pale pastels. And I think that's what we saw. Republicans, I keep a copy of the Republican autopsy from 2012, literally on my on my computer, because it's so funny. But also, we shouldn't forget it. Because when people say, oh, conservatives were fighting the culture war for years and years. Yeah, no, conservatives may have been, but the Republican Party and the Beltway apparatus absolutely was not. And they were saying that people like Glenn Youngkin were great candidates because they will speak in pale pastels, as long as it's about the cultural issues. They'll be very bold on tax cuts, but culture, you'll see that be very pale. And to all the people saying, you know, this is not vindicating for social conservatives because Glenn Youngkin is this sort of woke corporatist. And by the way, he is. I remember I reported during the primary on a letter he signed sort of groveling to BLM. He's had comments about LGBTQ issues while he was head of the Carlyle group. So yeah, but that's sort of the point, right? Is that somebody who in the past would have been a messenger and a vehicle for the pale pastels of sort of establishment cultural leftism was quite the opposite. And I do think that's very vindicating.
I think it's going to be interesting to watch him deliver. And I think that this is sort of the next step for Republicans on this issue. Michael Lind had a long essay in Tablet magazine. I think it was yesterday, the day before. Actually, his takeaway from Virginia was that the consensus of neoliberalism is coming back to the forefront. And Glenn Youngkin is sort of embodying that. And, you know, he is that person, right? But I think we're all hoping that because, you know, he was galvanized on the campaign trail by these issues and he saw the energy and he saw the momentum that they created in the people he is now going to govern, that he will deliver on these questions. But I do think it's a long-term problem for the Republican Party because, as Michael Lind points out, and I think we would all agree with, the establishment center of the Republican base agrees with Democrats. They don't say it loudly, but they agree with Democrats on funding abortion. They agree with Democrats on LGBTQ issues. They agree on gender neutral bathrooms, like all these things that really galvanize sort of the base of the Republican Party, the establishment does not agree with. So I think that what happened in Virginia does prove a lot of the things that Josh and Emily were pointing out, that conservatives can win and will win by leaning into these issues. But it is going to be the rage, I think, that exists in the base is not going to be ameliorated unless there is actual delivery. And that's sort of the next phase that we're now in.
Yeah, so I'd say I was heartened to see that really people across the country were galvanized on sort of more fundamental and basic issues than, you know, marginal tax rates or social welfare programs or the like, from not just Virginia, but to New Jersey, Minneapolis, in terms of disbanding the police department. New Jersey, it seems that opposition to lockdowns, which of course impacted parents of children who were kept out of school for months on end disproportionately, also seemed to almost rallied Jack Cittarelli, the Republican candidate, to a dramatic, dramatic upset victory. And it appears may have knocked out the state Senate president as well, longtime powerful Democrat, moderate so-called labor tied figure as well. So, you know, when I look at it with the McAuliffe so-called gaffe, I would say McAuliffe was being honest about what Democrats and their union allies led by Randy Weingarten, no relation, believe about educators, which is that, yeah, we determine what your kids learn. You shut up and sit down, even though, by the way, you are paying for this with your tax dollars and they're your children. So I think they exposed their view quite clearly, their technocratic progressive view about molding the next generation and future generations at their whim. And I think it's powerful that that was exposed so concretely there. And when I look at the issues, it's really law and order. The notion that you should reward and essentially appease criminality went down at the ballot box. Lockdowns to an extent went down at the ballot box. And lastly, indoctrinating your kids. And as Josh noted, race essentialism and America last, America loathing milieu also went down. So I'm heartened that at least some percentage of Americans, and we have to look at sort of turnout totals and by party across the board. But in Virginia, for example, there was just broad turnout, period, full stop. In New Jersey, for example, it was more Republicans and independents who were animated by this race. But I think it's a positive thing to know that the public was angry enough and shocked enough and aghast enough at the woke agenda that's really been imposed over the last year plus to come out and vote accordingly. So we should be happy about that and cautiously optimistic, if not probably pessimistic, about what the Republican Party will take away as the lessons and whether or not they will bridge the chasm between the establishment and the voters who actually support them year in and year out.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans never seem to learn the right lessons when something like this is put on their table. But the positive that I guess I personally have tried to kind of focus on is that I am damn well sure that Democrats are not going to learn the right lessons either, right? I mean, like the woke mob there, they show really just with one example, kind of like the Iron Dome funding recently, how much outsized clout this group of like five or six crazies can show. So there's no way they're going to back down on CRT or any of this stuff either. But let's keep this moving along. So Ben, let's toss it right back to you to talk about what's going on with Russiagate.
Sure. So I'm going to try to not go too deep into the weeds of the latest indictment from the John Durham special investigation. And this is the third indictment issued, and it regards Igor Denchenko, who was an American of Russian descent, formerly worked at Brookings Institution. And he was the primary source for Christopher Steele, who was hired by Fusion GPS on behalf of the Clinton campaign to help craft that dossier that was used as the fundamental basis for four FISA warrant applications on Carter Page, nominal Trump campaign foreign policy advisor, which was sort of one of the central points, both Carter Page being tied to Russia and then the dossier itself, central pieces of evidence used to justify the whole narrative of Russian collusion, Russian conspiracy, and the subsequent investigations that took place. So what this indictment shows that Denchenko, the key source for the Steele dossier, which was probably the key document at the heart of the Russiagate / Spygate conspiracy, that source lied to the FBI in a number of different respects. And he is charged with five counts of allegedly lying to the FBI. And what that indictment shows, a couple of very high level points in it, or that it appears the FBI knew pretty early in 2017, based on Denchenko's own remarks, of course, that what he was reporting and what was captured in the Steele dossier was in large part a consequence of hearsay from his friends, secondhand information. Now, the sort of what was reported was that the intelligence community and Denchenko and Steele essentially gleaned some of this information from unnamed Russian sources. But what this indictment shows is that actually one of Denchenko's key sources behind some of the biggest bombshell allegations was actually Charles Dolan Jr., who's characterized as a PR executive with substantial ties to Russia. And I'll get to that in a second, who represented Russian officials. But more importantly, what Dolan told to Denchenko, which ended up in the Steele dossier in this crazy game of telephone, was not gleaned from Russians. This was Dolan information, which he in part gleaned from public news reporting and then from his own visits to Russia. So basically, you had a Clinton operative in Dolan who had worked in the Bill Clinton White House, who had worked on the 2008 and 2016 Hillary campaigns. And he claims that the campaign was not aware of what he reported to Danchenko that the campaign paid for via Steele. But basically, a Clinton operative was one of the sources for Danchenko, who's one of the sources for Steele, one of the sources for the entire dossier. And then also that one of the other key sources, the head of this Russian-American Chamber of Commerce, Sergey Milian, Igor Danchenko claimed he was a source, and it turns out he was not a source for the information that ended up in the dossier. So critical points here pointing to the fact that the whole dossier narrative should have collapsed from the start. The FBI, it appears, knew Danchenko was lying about certain key points, including that Dolan was a source in the first place, which should have further called into question why the FBI continued this investigation of around Russian collusion, given how shoddy the source was of the Steele dossier. But then more importantly, the fact that, well, for starters, Danchenko himself is linked to Fiona Hill, a central player in impeachment 1.0 against the Trump presidency. Danchenko was actually linked up with Charles Dolan, this source, via Fiona Hill. Fiona Hill had linked up Danchenko with Steele in the first place. Fiona Hill herself had worked at Brookings along with Danchenko, so the relationship goes back a long ways. It appears Strobe Talbot, the longtime and former president of Brookings as well, was involved in the dossier development. So there are all of these different links, ties, and coordination, not between Russia and Trump and those around him, but the Clinton campaign and all of these operatives in its network, who then, of course, flooded, as we've reported at Real Clear Investigations, where I serve as deputy editor, who tried to push this sort of information to the CIA, the State Department, the FBI, and beyond. So the U.S. government was getting this information from all sides, from all these different sources linked to the Hillary Clinton campaign, not to Russia. That's where the real collusion is. And Durham has set this up essentially at the sort of seed of Russiagate, which is, you know, basically the Clinton campaign creating this narrative and playing this dirty trick to spread it throughout the U.S. government and try to have a thousand flowers bloom around Russian collusion, essentially. But then there's the question of U.S. government officials, it seems, knew this was garbage during 2017. Yet the FISA warrant applications continued. Of course, we get to the Mueller special counsel itself. And so the question is quickly going to become, okay, was the U.S. government a patsy here? And this is all in the Hillary Clinton campaign that pulled the dirty trick. Or in fact, did the U.S. government in effect collude with the Clinton campaign to try to bring down President Trump and all those around him? And I would suggest that the U.S. government, it's very clear, knew this was garbage and continued to pursue it for months on end. And the fact that we're only starting to get to the truth of everything that transpired 5 years later is proof that you can make a better argument that the Mueller special counsel was more of a cover-up than an actual investigation of what transpired. So there's so many different details and rabbit holes that one can go down in this, but I think the biggest takeaway is something that Lee Smith has been hammering home for years, which is that this was not a Russian misinformation or disinformation operation. This was a Clinton campaign operation with witting allies in the U.S. government and, of course, across the media as well. These indictments indict all of these players, but the real question in terms of whether or not we'll have any justice whatsoever is whether government officials involved with perpetuating this narrative and pursuing all of these figures and trying to destroy them in a political jihad will themselves face justice. So with that, you know, I'd turn it over to the group and I'd say, do you think that this is ultimately going to be about Clinton operatives going down and then Durham writes a report at the end, which creates smoke, but not necessarily a fire around U.S. government officials involved? Or are we going to get actual justice at the end of the day?
I think the question sadly answers itself, right? I mean, first of all, this has transpired over so many years now, right? I mean, we're in November 2021. The 2016 presidential election was literally 5 years ago. Americans kind of have like a famously short attention span as it is. Even I think like a lot of Republicans, like as horrific as all this nonsense was in 2016, I think even Republicans now are disproportionately focusing on trying to fix all of the kind of ad hoc voting procedures and everything that went wrong in the 2020 election. So even for people kind of on our side, I think a lot of the attention span for what went wrong in 2016 is kind of in the rearview mirror. I mean, look, in a just country, people would pay for this. Like people would go to jail for this. People would people would rot behind bars for this sort of foisting of just a horrific kind of scandal, and scandals, right, where a scandal of this nature and just thrusting it onto the American citizenry. But I guess the other thing that makes me a little pessimistic is, like, it's very complicated, right? There's a lot of names here. I mean, I literally try to do this for a living, and I'll be honest with you, Ben, like, when I listen, because you're so much more informed on this, frankly, than I am, or I would hazard a guess that Rachel or Emily are. Like, when I hear you, like, speak with, like, that level of, like, commanding authority, I mean, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all of the relevant names. So I can only imagine, like, how, like, XYZ Republican congressman, let alone, like, their junior mid-level staffers are trying to put all the pieces together here. So I it's a horrific scandal, but I'm not exactly bullish when it comes to the odds that we're going to see meaningful justice for any of this either.
One thing that strikes me, because I find myself in Josh's situation too, where it's like there's so many threads and so many, you know, personalities that you're trying to keep track of. But I keep coming back to, again and again, the role of the FBI in perpetuating this whole Russia hoax and allowing it to spark and flame and then literally just, like, blowing on the flame so it became a giant fire. Like, how long are we going to put up with this crap from the FBI? Because this is not their only crime, right? I'm sort of taking it out of the bounds of this segment slightly, but, like, we have, you know, the FBI in this situation, we have the FBI sort of setting up and entrapping, you know, all these sort of white nationalist events, you know, even going so far as to say they were present, you know, in the January 6th protests, but we don't know who or how many, you know, all, like, how many times the role of the FBI in so much of what has happened over the last 4 to 5 years, I think, really deserves to be unpacked. And for me, working closely with members of Congress, that to me is a congressional question, because that is something they do have oversight over. And, you know, we've had one, I think, FBI lawyer go to jail, Kevin Kleinsmith, for falsifying a FISA evidence that led to a FISA warrant. But I think we need far more than that, because to me, the lack of accountability of government agents and the culpability, you know, accountability for the culpability and their role in this is just, I don't know how you can say we are a constitutional government when this is the case.
Yeah, I mean, quickly, that's all completely correct. And it is so convoluted because there were so many layers of corruption has been eliminated at the FBI and at the Clinton campaign. And even if you look at how many people that are implicated in this had filtered through the Brookings Institution.
Yeah.
It's not as though Brookings was individually sort of like conspiring behind closed doors. It's just that this is how the centers of power work here in Washington, D.C. And so this particular element of all of this, and Matt Taibbi has been from the left very on top of it in an interesting way. It is truly amazing how boldly people lied, because they assumed that they would be totally fine. They assumed there would be a Clinton presidency. They assumed that even if there wasn't a Clinton presidency, who's going to prosecute this? Who is actually going to figure any of this out? And to some extent, it was sort of like they thought there was a morality in lying, right? That it was like, yeah, it'll all be fine because we're doing this to save the Republic from the host of Celebrity Apprentice. So it's just like when you are able to zoom out to 30 feet, I think it's as stunning as when you're in the weeds. I actually think both are really stunning, because this is a good example of something that's in the weeds, Danchenko, that's in the weeds. And you look at it and you're like, are you serious? Like, you really were colluding on this level with a campaign, and then you zoom out and it's like, wow, it's just as crazy. So I think it's an indictment of Washington, D.C. and the sort of professional beltway class. And I don't know that lessons have been learned, because to the point that everybody's made, what level of accountability would be proportionate is not something that we've seen.
Rachel's just,
I was just going to say really quickly, to focus the mind, I think the big takeaways are the ways that civil liberties were trod on in just an unprecedented fashion in terms of the targeting of Carter Page and the abuse of the FISA court here, and the fact that the FISA court was not a break on any of this awful behavior, number one. Number two, the hyper-politicization and weaponization of our national security and intelligence apparatus, by the way, originally controlled by an Obama administration that Hillary Clinton served, never questioned in all of this. What did Barack Obama know? When did he know it? What did Joe Biden know? And when did he know it? What did Hillary Clinton know and when did she know it? All of those things. And then ultimately that if there is no justice, then we're in for far worse down the road. If everyone gets off scot-free here who is in the U.S. government, you know, the media figures, they have no shame in this, self-evidently. But when it comes to the political figures and also those in the national security, intelligence, law enforcement apparatus, if they do not pay a price for this, we are a banana republic. I mean, we're a third world country at that point. And, you know, when they go after Project Veritas over a diary that Project Veritas brought to them, and that's who they're pursuing right now, I think it shows that we're maybe past there. We're in a post third world place at this point.
Yeah, and super quick, and then we'll kick it back to Rachel here. I think the point that you, Ben, and Rachel, both you made about kind of the FBI and the IC in general, that should be the takeaway for Republicans going forward, even if they're not going to kind of get to the point where they can pursue individual justice against the miscreants and all the malfeasance that happened here. The structural reforms to the FBI, CIA, NSA, all of that, it's kind of a posthumous vindication of sorts for Angela Cotevilla, who, of course, wrote about this for so many decades. But let's keep this thing rolling. So over to you, Rachel.
So a brief change of topic, going back to Congress and the infrastructure bill, which we've been hearing about for, I don't know, years now that it's been infrastructure week. It was finally infrastructure week on Capitol Hill last week, where Democrats passed their bipartisan infrastructure bill late Friday night, close to midnight. And if you guys remember, or anyone who's watching this remembers the sort of Sturm und Drang around this, the so-called BIF, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, and its role as sort of a chit claimed by House progressives, but also by Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden in passing the much larger, you know, started at $3 trillion, now it's like $1.5-2 trillion reconciliation bill. So what was really shocking to me about this whole episode is the fact that both of these bills were linked for months. You know, we can't get to this massive giant reconciliation bill, which I think we've talked about on this podcast before, but it's just this massive, massive expansion of federal power, probably the biggest since the New Deal. We can't get to this thing we really want to pass, unless we first pass this BIF. This was self-evident to anyone who's been watching the process. Yet on Friday night, as this bill's coming to the floor, you have progressive defections. The bill is about to fail. And who snatches defeat from the jaws of victory but our favorite congressional Republicans, 13 of whom gave Nancy Pelosi the deciding votes to pass this infrastructure bill, thereby teeing up passage of this massive reconciliation bill, which was the goal the entire time. And the reason I want to bring this up is because there's always some debate, you know, in new right or populist circles, however you want to define it, that things like infrastructure, you know, are what we need to be focusing on, that, you know, this is where the federal government has a role. And if we can't support infrastructure, what can't we do? And there was this has been sort of an argument I've seen circulating. And I just want to rebut it out of the gate for two reasons. One is the idea that, you know, yes, we can have an argument about the federal government's role in infrastructure, but this infrastructure bill was not that. You know, not hardly at all, you know, went to sort of roads and bridges. Well, the big talking point was, oh, it has, you know, so much money for roads and bridges. No, it has so much money for climate change and subsidies for electric vehicles, and so much money for things like urban transit and Amtrak, you know, $66 billion being dumped yet again into the Amtrak system, subject to no reform. So we're going to be here just back again in 3 years. You know, this is not the product that I think, you know, sort of nationalist or populist or new right, whatever, conservatives want to line up behind. I think we have to have standards. Like, if we want to talk about infrastructure, great, but we have to have standards for what that looks like. And this wasn't that. But second, I think, you know, for a young movement, we have to be savvy about the politics. And this was all about politics. The substance of the BIF stopped mattering 5 months ago. And it was just a chit that was being used to get to this bigger end, which was this reconciliation bill. And the inability to see that for these 13 Republicans, which included, right, a lot of retiring Republicans and Republicans like Adam Kinzinger, who is basically a Democrat, but also two members of the House leadership team. You had John Katko, who's the ranking member of the House Homeland Security Committee, and Nicole Malliotakis, who's an assistant whip. Even for these for this House leadership members to go in and give, again, Democrats this massive win, setting up this reconciliation bill that we've been fighting all year, I think is just disqualifying. And so the ability to appreciate the politics of what's going on here, I think, is vital, especially for more nationalist, you know, movement conservative types who are saying, oh, infrastructure is what we need to focus on. Well, before you can even get to that, you have to understand the politics at work. So all that to say, you know, that's one angle I'm very focused on. The second is that, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in Kevin McCarthy's whip operation after this, because it clearly failed in a big way.
Yeah, I literally just forwarded Rachel an email about that. So it's completely true that, I mean, 13, you know, maybe one or two is excusable. 13 is crazy. People like Nicole Malliotakis, who may have been sort of seduced by spending for the subway in New York City, is a good example, right? And that you're going to have people go back to their districts and say, we put politics aside and we just did what was good for our people. And to act as though they were transcending partisanship and partisan politics, and that's what they're going to take back to their district. But the cost-benefit analysis with a bill like this that Rachel just mentioned is completely larded up with leftist social spending and bad government spending. To sort of the cost-benefit analysis is clearly on one side over the other. And so I think it is a pretty stunning failure of Republican leadership. Did they see this coming? Seriously, I'm genuinely curious. Because I don't think that they did. I think they were just sort of, they had no idea. And if they did, they didn't care enough. This is a huge, huge win for Democrats, but not for the public, no matter how much an individual's district may sort of individually benefit. So I agree completely with Rachel. I think there has to be a conversation about, there. You know, Orrin Cass is excellent on this. That needs to transfer to the actual party on what this policy platform looks like. And then you have to sort of, it's easy to sort of Monday morning quarterback people who actually have to sit down and take votes. I get it. And they look at people who criticize them from podcasts and whatever, as, you know, it's easy to do this when you don't have to vote and don't have to go back to your voters. But it's also easy to reject really horrendous bills. And that's what just happened. So it's I think, a statement on whether the Republican Party has the stones to go forward.
So there's a lot going on here, obviously. I mean, look, infrastructure, it's talking about like actual infrastructure, should in theory be a bipartisan issue, right? I mean, there's a very, very, very long running strand of thought where this is kind of like a profoundly conservative kind of nationalist issue, right? You know, our Edmund Burke Foundation colleague, David Bragg, had this wonderful essay about a year ago at American Affairs, kind of trying to like recover the conservative economics tradition, talking a lot about Burke and Hamilton, all of that. And David has a line there. He's quoting Abraham Lincoln himself. Abraham Lincoln kind of modeled his political economy on Henry Clay of Kentucky. It was kind of like his like boyhood hero. I think it was Abraham Lincoln had this line. I'm paraphrasing here a little bit. He said, my politics are slow and sweet, like the widow's dance. I support internal improvements, a strong central bank, and protective tariffs. You know, kind of all about kind of this industrial policy, kind of like Hamiltonian vision of America. So there's a very long tradition here, right, for like supporting, like in the modern context, whether it's rail or roads or any of that. But the point here, I think the tension that we've seen kind of play out, and this is really kind of inside baseball stuff, right? But, you know, Rachel and I, both in the board of advisors of American Moment, a very kind of precocious young American Moment fellow named Chase Reed kind of had this Substack post basically saying, like, why are people on the quote unquote new right objecting to this? Both Rachel and our fellow board member, Ryan Gruduski, said, oh, here's why we're objecting to it. So just quotes from Ryan Gruduski's Substack post about this. I'm looking at it right now here. So the bill has $110 billion for road repair, $66 billion in railroads, $65 billion for the power grid, $39 billion for public transportation, which is like literally nothing. All of this is totally dwarfed by these, what the Democrats and the wokesters refer to as human infrastructure. Okay, $400 billion in universal pre-K, $200 billion of additional child tax credits, which, you know, in theory, a lot of us probably can support, probably not the way it's going to be doled out in this bill. So the upshot here is like, there's just like a basic miscommunication, I think, right? Where like we can and should support like better airports, better rail. I mean, look, Amtrak is a freaking disaster. Okay. I mean, like I, as someone who has been, I remember I was on like a high-speed train in Japan a couple of years ago, going from Tokyo to Kyoto, traveling 240 miles per hour. It was awesome. It was so cool. Like, and I'm not necessarily saying we should try to emulate high-speed rail in America for everywhere, probably outside the Northeast corridor. It doesn't make much sense here, but in theory, these are things that we can support. It doesn't mean supporting kind of a bill of this nature, to say nothing of kind of the direct political linkage, of course, the reconciliation package that Rachel talked about as well. So there's just a lot to unpack here. And I think a lot of people are kind of talking about it in overly simplistic terms.
Yeah, once again, I'd say for those Republicans who did go along with this under the belief that, well, either the Democrats had something over, some kind of leverage over them that they felt was going to lead to them getting knocked out in 2022, or they simply lacked the courage to make the case to their voters that whatever pork benefits might be gained would be far outweighed by the losses here. I think this comes down to, once again, not having an understanding of the stakes and or an issue of something as simple as the evil party versus stupid party sort of duality that is, you know, it's hackneyed, but I think does play out at times, because the incompetence here would seem to be rank from the top on down, to the extent that leadership failed to get these other Republicans in line and shore them up in some way, to the extent that this was going to be perceived as a tough vote within their districts. So I think this is really a case of, can't anybody here play this game sort of view of the Republican Party? Short-sightedness to the extent it really was a belief that the pork was better than the political losses that are going to transpire as a consequence of this, and the substantive losses as a consequence of this. And I think that we need to, if really our worldview is the one that ought to triumph, then those Republicans who voted with this ought to be primaried. And let's see if the voters respond accordingly. And the case needs to be made to them, I think, strongly, that these votes are unconscionable, given the state of play and where the Democrats are and what this means for 2022 and beyond.
Any last thoughts, Rachel, before we transition?
Well, I will just point out that I think Marjorie Taylor Greene, one of the highest grossing Republicans in the House, literally, she's raised more money than almost anyone, has announced she's going to primary those guys. So I don't know if she will or not, but she has the money to do it.
Maybe she could get some help from the Nation of Islam.
Yeah, well, okay, Nancy Mace.
that's a joke, because Marjorie Taylor Greene had a genuinely interesting Twitter thread about her experience in a prison. She was touring to see the conditions that January 6th defendants are in, and found some common cause on with the Nation of Islam. And you could go look that thread up if you want to read it. it was an interesting dust up. But actually, our transition here is really smooth, because what we're going to talk about is Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg coming back from parental leave and saying that he will use funding from the infrastructure bill to address racial inequities in highways. He made this point yesterday at a White House press briefing. And when I say yesterday, I'm referring to Monday. We were taping on Tuesday at a White House press briefing. And it gets to something really interesting that we've talked about here before. And I remember I wrote a piece about this a little while back after Katie Herzog reported out on Barry Weiss's Substack that doctors were sort of so afraid of woke ideology that they were actually lowering their treatment of patients, like their standard for treatment of patients, because to treat people adequately, you would sort of risk being called racist. And there's a real thing here about how we can't even do infrastructure in this country, because Democrats have to make it human infrastructure. They have to make it woke infrastructure. They can't actually just do straight infrastructure, and they can't actually just put money where it needs to be allocated. And it's not just Democrats, of course. Again, we have 13 Republicans voting for this bill, which allowed it to pass. So we're in the state in our country where our efficiency is being hampered by this very decadent ideology. And I think that's a point that is really well worth remembering. There were vaccine distributions on racial bases in certain states. When you have doctors lowering their standard of care to avoid taking any risks of upsetting sort of a mob, there are serious ways in which our ability to function as a country, to spend money on infrastructure, to pass infrastructure legislation through Congress that would actually repair things like roads and bridges, like that American Moment, the precocious American Moment fellow that Josh mentioned wants. These are great goals, but we are hampered not only by the sort of typical Washington issues of lobbying and everything else, but now by this very decadent ideology that gets in the way, because Pete Buttigieg can't spend this money without addressing And I'll read the quote here, without addressing the racial issues in highways. This is a program called, quote, Reconnecting Communities, that according to Axios will focus on the, quote, legacy of highway construction built through communities and remove or repurpose infrastructure barriers. And that's, I think, here's another, this is actually another relevant quote. If an underpass was constructed such that a bus carrying mostly Black and Puerto Rican kids to a beach in New York was designed too low for it to pass by, that obviously reflects racism that went into those design choices. I don't think we have anything to lose by confronting that simple reality. And I think we have everything to gain by acknowledging it. Well, acknowledging is an interesting word. Acknowledging, what does acknowledging mean? Does it mean that you're going to spend money on these sort of lofty woke priorities that don't actually address racism, but maybe just like reallocate resources for the superficial branding benefit of it? And that's almost certainly going to be the case. So with all of that, I'll open the floor up. What did you guys think of Secretary Pete's comments at the White House briefing?
It was interesting because I engaged this on Twitter yesterday afternoon, that this was like a very, like, I was like, the stupidity of the moment we live in cannot be overstated when this is what's being asked. And this CNN reporter jumped on my throat and was like, he's talking about the legacy of Robert Moses. And obviously Robert Moses being the great Democratic partisan of New York, who used infrastructure to sort of, you know, break up minority, you know, thriving, otherwise thriving minority communities. But this was also 100 years ago, I would point out, that this happened. And, you know, yes, you can talk about that. And maybe the state of New York wants to take some action on that. That's sort of their bailiwick. But to house the entire infrastructure debate in this idea that it is rooted and grounded solely in this idea of systemic racism, I just think is insane. And you saw this in the infrastructure debate too. Like, within that infrastructure bill, you had like racial categorizations for, you know, collection of bike, you know, bicyclist mortality was like broken down by racial categories, and, you know, racial lines being drawn in communities for like how we would gather data. Like, this is racist terminology infusing how we do basic governance. It's like, sometimes, you know, I see this stuff and I'm like, did the Klan write this? Because there is no other way for me to look at this, because it's race obsessed. And that is literally what the Klan was about. And yet it is now seeping into our modern governance parlance. And this is what we talk about when we say woke ideology is ruining America. It's this.
So I don't have a whole lot to add to this. I'm just going to quote J.D. Vance's tweet on this, which I thought was highly accurate. So I'm just going to read off this. So J.D. is quote tweeting, you know, this clip of April Ryan, the CNN reporter, asking Secretary Buttigieg about, I'm having a hard time not laughing. I just can't believe we're going to talk about this, honestly. I'm talking about like the deconstructing the racism of the roadway. So J.D. Vance quote tweets this. He says, "Nothing in this country works. It takes years to repair a bridge that was built in far less time. Every big city has skyrocketing murder rates. China is about to take over the world, even as we name Navy ships after pedophiles. And our reporters ask about the racism of our roads." So look, that in a nutshell is like the state of America in the year 2021, right? It's kind of another like running like theme, a leitmotif, you might say, of our NatCon Squad podcast going back many months now, is like when just stupid crap like this happens and it gets amplified by all the usual suspects in the Twitter sphere, Xi Jinping just kind of leans back, he kicks his feet up onto the table, and he has a nice laugh about it. This in a nutshell is kind of the very decadence that Ross Douthat of the New York Times has written about, right? Increasingly, in his book, in his Substack post, we have a decadent ruling class in this country that cares about these ridiculous issues that they're able to kind of project onto the people and just kind of pat themselves in the back. It's a pure kind of virtue signaling mechanism. None of this redounds to the concrete, tangible, beneficial interests of the American people. That was kind of the whole debate we just had in the previous segment about whether this was real infrastructure or fake infrastructure. It's all fake. It's all performative. It's all performative for kind of a cloistered, intellectually myopic subset of ruling class elites. And this ultimately is why America is kind of falling down the crapper, honestly, like, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, like, it is just this sort of focus to the exclusion of the end. China is literally launching hypersonic missiles around the world, people. They're launching hypersonic missiles in like split seconds around the world. And we have very serious journalists in the White House asking Pete Buttigieg about the racism of our roadways.
By the way, can I just say too, like, you know, Pete is going to be like, yes, I'm going to do this because otherwise I'd have to fix the supply chains and I can't do that. I'm like physically incapable of fixing the supply chains. So yeah. Racist roads it is.
Just unbelievable. I mean, I'll get off my soapbox on that, but all you, Ben.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Obama administration did have a tactic of stray voltage where they would put out something like this to get us and everyone else chasing a story about Robert Moses and the power broker, which, by the way, I mean, to the point of our last segment, you know, Republicans could learn something from reading the power broker, at least about how ruthless the other side is in pursuit of their goals. So worth stating that. I do think that the big takeaway is that we shouldn't be surprised that there's this equity language in anything and everything that comes out of the administration, because one of the first things President Biden did was issue an executive order. I think the exact terminology was on affirmatively advancing equity. And it called for a whole of government strategy to advance equity. So when you have the left saying that CRT is a made up right wing boogeyman or whatever, no, it's right here. It's right in front of our faces. It is our federal government. This is the ideology of our regime. It's racial Marxism. And it does have, and I think to Emily's point, it's really important to emphasize this over and over. It does have disastrous real world consequences in terms of whole areas of subject matter that you're not allowed to explore or investigate, in terms of medical research that won't be done on grounds of essentially being politically correct in accordance with equity principles. And then obviously, in terms of the consequences of the policies, when you get to things we've talked about, like defund the police, who does that hurt most? Well, that hurts most those who are law-abiding citizens in the most dangerous areas of the country. Look, one thing that I've tried to hammer home, even though, you know, hypocrisy is sort of a feature, not a bug, of the left. Look at the vaccine mandates. If disparate impact, the idea that policies disproportionately hurt one race over another race, is demonstrative of racism, then how could you say that vaccine mandates are not systemically racist at their core? So it's either disparate impact proves racism, or you don't believe that disparate impact proves racism. You have to pick a side. I'd put that to the left, and I'd make that case in almost all of these policies. Almost every single leftist policy that they claim to be about advancing equity or the like ultimately disproportionately hurts those who they claim to help the most. And that has to be raised every single time we get into any one of these segments about an equity agenda or combating systemic racism or the like. Ultimately, it leads to poverty, misery, and division, which the left loves because they can exploit that for their political ends. But the American people suffer the most, and those who the left claims to care about also suffer the most.
I think we have time just for quick final thoughts, and I will start mine just by very quickly saying on that point, on the points that everyone made, actually, and I think one thing that Rachel said stands out, that it reminds me of how hollow and empty and inefficient this system of morality is, right? So the left's morality has metastasized in academia for years and years and years without any challenges, right? Like, they don't respond to people who actually have reasonable and substantive dissents to them. They dismiss them. They say they're racist. We just saw this happen in Virginia, to sort of bring things full circle. And that's why, like, when they try to actually address real racism, they end up with these super decadent, out of touch, unrealistic solutions. And that's sort of actually a sad thing for the goal and mission of racial equity, because we should be able to address all these things. As Rachel said, maybe New York does need to do something, but whatever this is, you know, that's it. Whatever this is, it's not it. And so their morality is hollow and corrupt, and it's our governing ideology now. So if anyone else has final thoughts, I'll open it up to the group.
I mean, this kind of goes like to the point that I tried to make last week when I was speaking at NatCon, which is that this woke ideology is the most destructive force I think I've seen in, most destructive force the country faces in a generation. And people on the right who are incapable of grasping how destructive it is and how it needs to be opposed are not qualified to lead the party. They are not qualified to lead the country, and they're not qualified to lead the conservative movement. This, to me, because this theory of governance, and it's just, as we've discussed, a performative, decadent ideology that means nothing except benefiting the material interests of those of promoting it, it is, it's everywhere. It's pervaded our government, our institutions, you know, our cultural, intellectual institutions. So it needs to be taken on immediately. And this I think is the task of the right. And when we select our next leader, this has to be a threshold question.
And I'll just build off that real quick for my own final thoughts, Simon, which is, you know, we did just have the NatCon 2 conference in Orlando here. And I think some of the chatter has been, even from some, you know, of our friendlies, people who are there, like, oh, what do they mean? What does it stand for here? Well, I think if it means anything, right, and this obviously still is kind of a work in progress, and all of us who are kind of adjacent or in this are going to continue to flesh it out. But if it means anything, it is mobilizing all levers of power to oppose what it is that Rachel just laid out, which is the woke ideology, which I agree. I think we all agree is the greatest threat that America has faced in decades. And when we talk about mobilizing power, we're talking about mobilizing power, obviously, you know, not just as far as kind of like tax cuts or deregulation or anything, but actually willing to wield state power if need be to rein in destructive forces, whether that is the Ford Foundation, whether that is the higher ed bureaucracy, the accreditation services, whether it is the big tech oligarchs, whatever, you name it, that is where the threat is coming from. And that's where we need to kind of focus our political energy for the time being. So, you know, we're going to continue to flesh that out, obviously, but that is kind of in a nutshell, I think, what our vision of where the right needs to go, in contrast to kind of just a more kind of hands-off, you know, I'm not even going to say Reaganite, because Reagan, I think, probably understood this better than the so-called Reaganites themselves do. it's kind of in a way like the Bork consumer welfare standard, right? I mean, Bob Bork didn't actually stand for what a lot of his acolytes think. But anyway, I'm no reason to get too far in the weeds there. But anyway, we oppose this ridiculously kind of neoliberal inspired notion that you can't get your hands dirty to actually punish the wokesters, if nothing else, I think.
First, I just want to say it was really heartening to meet with and spend time with kindred spirits, including a lot of the viewers or listeners of this program, especially coming from the Northeast, surrounded by people who have lost their minds over the last 20 months. It was just amazing to be in the flesh with actual like-minded patriotic Americans. So I really appreciated the opportunity to come down to NatCon 2. And to the broader point about NatCon 2, I've seen a number of articles out there talking about, you know, how do we make sense of this wide, disparate sort of set of speakers and interlocutors during the conference? What are we to make of it? How do we make sense of it? What makes it coherent? And I'm going to be writing something. It'll probably be out by the time of our next week's broadcast in the Federalist, talking about kind of what I viewed stepping back from the conference as unites us. And I think it's three things. First is a common understanding of the threat of wokeism, and then combined with communist China. So sort of the cold civil war at home, plus the hot war by other means that we're facing from abroad, focuses the mind in a way in terms of existential threats that require coming together and using new methods and tactics and strategies as well that might not otherwise be undertaken, but we're in effectively wartime situation. And that brings me to number two, which is that I think there's a broad understanding that the old methods have failed in the face of these threats. If you're facing not just a whole of government, but a whole of society assault on everything that you hold dear, that requires a different response, to Josh's point, wielding all levers of power in new and novel ways to combat a threat that is new and novel. And lastly, I think we're not talking about tax policy or deregulatory policies. You know, we've talked a lot about how we need to engage in a culture war, and that actually does matter to people because that hits them in part at their heart. But it's also, it gets to the more fundamental things. And I think what we do agree on is that, unlike, say, during the Cold War, where broadly there's a shared kind of understanding of here are American values and principles, our country is good, we have a positive view of our history generally for all of the warts that may have existed, we do not have that sort of shared understanding now. But I do think that more than 50% of the country probably does. And if there's a takeaway for me from NatCon 2, it's that we have a basic agreement on those most fundamental things about love of country, about a belief in safe and orderly communities against kind of the social dysfunction and chaos that is brought about by wokeism writ large. And so I go through in this article that'll be out in the Federalist kind of what I think are the things that actually unite us as well. And they get to this question of more fundamental things are at stake. We can't even be having debates about what's the proper marginal tax rate or abolish the administrative state or not, or social welfare programs or any of these things. We're talking about the country itself and its most basic fundamental principles. And I think that's where we do have a shared vision. And I try to articulate that a little bit more clearly in a piece to come. So stay tuned for that.
Well, on behalf of Ben, Rachel, Josh, and myself, thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Emily Jashinsky, and we'll see you at the next NatCon Squad.